Join us at Wavemakers Live with me, Shelley Reback, your host of Midpoint, on April 8th at the Commodore with Robert Fiesler, historian and author of the multiple award-winning book, American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives. Robert is a very engaging speaker, and he'll be in conversation with me on Wednesday, April 8th at 7 p.m. at the Commodore. Tickets are $10 in advance, $15 at the door, and you can get your tickets on the event page at WMNF.org. I hope to see you there.
Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Armando Ubeda.
Good morning. How are you?
No, sorry. I was just verifying I had the pronunciation correct. Well, I'll get back to you in a sec. Sorry, Armando. Primarily appearing in his guise as a shark expert, which is to say his CV is notably long and wide. For instance, he's worked as a coral reef researcher in Nicaragua and a staff biologist at the Department of Shark Research at Moat Marine Laboratory in the U.S., while in a previous position, he served as Mesoamerican Program Manager for a conservation organization called Lighthawk. Armando received his bachelor's degree in marine sciences with a minor in chemistry from the University of Mobile's Latin American campus and his master's degree in marine resource management from Oregon State University. He's a PhD candidate at the Wildlife Ecology and Conservation Department at the University of Florida, and his research focuses on shark reproductive behavior and population structure. He's slated to give a talk entitled Coastal Sharks of Florida on April 10th as part of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival happening April 9th through 12th in and around Apollo Beach, featuring lectures, field trips, boat trips, nature expo, and more. The festival website presenting the schedule and other information is floridabirdingandnaturefestival.org. So, various facets of sharks and more when I speak with Armando Ubeda here in just a moment on Talking Animals on WNF. Coming up later on today's program, I'll talk with Ann Paul, an organizer of the Florida Birding Nature Festival, the aforementioned. Again, a multifaceted, multi-day extravaganza scheduled to take place April 9th through 12th in and around Apollo Beach. We know, of course, that Armando will be giving a talk there on sharks, but we'll also ask Ann to outline some of the other programming that will be offered. So more on that coming up later when Ann Paul joins us on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation with Armando with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Armando Ubeda to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Armando.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
So we're here today chiefly to discuss various aspects of sharks, which I look forward to doing in just a moment. But first, I'd like to explore the academic pursuits and sort of other endeavors you undertook that placed you on the path as a PhD candidate with a thesis focused on sharks. So being in the sea and studying, it seems to be kind of a through line of the Armando story. When did you first feel intrigued by the ocean?
When I was a really very little. When I was a kid, we always spent, you know, our vacations basically in tide in at the Pacific Ocean. So I was always time snorkeling and swimming in tidal pools. So I was always fascinated by marine life.
And where did you grow up, Armando?
In Nicaragua, Central America.
That's okay, where I grew up. I had a hunch, but I wasn't quite sure. Yeah. So was the ocean also a source of pleasure and recreation? Like, were you swimming and surfing and, you know, snorkeling and doing all those things?
Yeah,
as well?
all that stuff, from surfing to scuba diving to just, you know, going swimming and spending time and exploring, really. That I had a fascination for exploring and discovering. So I always tried to spend so much time in places that a lot of people didn't go.
Right.
And that's under the sea, you know.
And it just meant a lot to you. It was just kind of magical, I guess, all the way around.
It was.
So as a result, to what extent do you feel more connected, maybe even more protective of the ocean as a scientist, but of course as a just a citizen of the planet as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do care for nature, right? So the ocean, and not just for animals, like plants as well. So I do a lot of work with ecosystem and habitat, things like that, and also animals as well. But yeah, my heart is with the ocean and with nature in general.
So what ways might your view of the ocean change over the years since you're a whippersnapper growing up in Nicaragua and enjoying the water and the stuff you've done since? Like over time, is there some evolution in your way you look at the ocean and what it means to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was growing up, obviously my reach of knowledge was very local, and then you start traveling and things and growing up, right? I've been here in Florida for 20 years now, and you see changes through time, you know, coastal development, and how population expansion is also encroaching some of these natural areas that we care for, or, you know, that I used to see or grew up with. There were not as many people there around. So that changed nature itself. So some good things and bad things has happened through the years. But yeah, my understanding of the ocean and the threats and the needs and things like that has widened, and just because of my experience, right?
Yeah. So we kind of touched on it a moment ago. So part of your huge CV notes, your stint as a coral reef researcher in Nicaragua. When was this, like what year, and what were your findings?
This is a long time ago. So this is 1998, 1999. I had the luxury to be hired to help with that research in coral reef in the eastern side of Nicaragua, which is still a little bit isolated from the Pacific side, so less populated. It's grown quite a bit, but we had the opportunity to go and map and do some studies in terms of coral reef communities. So looking at abundance and diversity of coral reef species in these islands on the east coast of Nicaragua. There was nobody there living in them. So it was a very pristine environment. And I had the luxury to basically scuba dive almost every day, taking data and then analyzing the data and presenting results. But it was very fascinating and a very good experience for me as well, growing up, you know.
And how does that compare what you were finding then? How does that compare with the coral issues that people are often writing about and talking about these days in Florida?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, some of the coral issues that we have now are actually newer issues. Like you always had the issues with, you know, coastal development, sedimentation, things like that, erosion, things. But now we have new things that have emerged, and a lot of them have to do with, you know, climate change, temperature of the seawater is increasing. So there's other things that happening that we didn't have before, like the bleaching of corals and things like that. That was not a major threat as it is now. And some diseases, right? I also knew diseases that are affecting corals. So those are the new things, I guess, that we didn't see before. And in some areas of the world, tourism too wasn't as developed as it is now. So tourism can be a really good thing for communities, obviously ecotourism. But if it's done poorly or managed poorly, it can be a lot of damage, especially to coral reef communities. And so we see that some impact now, right? Some areas that are heavily used by the public can be in peril because of that.
So would you say on a larger scale, though, is climate change that's really been shifting the way the coral has been affected?
Yes, absolutely. Because we have done, you know, we're managing our systems a little better in some countries, right? When it comes to fisheries, how you fish for things without damaging the coral reef and things like that. But yeah, but things put in a lot of pressure on our reef, which is mainly driven by climate change.
Any lessons you can take from years ago doing that kind of research in Nicaragua that you can apply now, even though that's not your focus at the moment, I realize, but you're probably always interested in like different ways to help solve problems, including with the coral.
Yeah, I think one of the main keys to conserve and protect some of these, you know, ecosystems or even organisms is educate the public. So I am now an educator. That's part of my being a Florida Extension, Florida Sea Grant Extension agent. But he's talking to people about the things that we have around us, because a lot of people don't care because they don't know what they have. So when they don't know what they have, they don't know what they lose as well. So
I think that's, and then it's too late, right?
Yeah, it's too late. Yeah. So I think that's a lesson learned through the years as well, is to expose more people to the wonderful things that we have.
Yeah. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Armando Ubeda, a shark expert with a CV that's, as we've noted, kind of long and wide and interested in all kinds of stuff and done all kinds of research and studying over the years. But he's currently a PhD candidate at the University of Florida, and his research focuses on shark reproductive behavior and population structure. He's slated to give a talk entitled Coastal Sharks of Florida on April 10th, part of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival happening April 9th through 12th in and around Apollo Beach. So if you'd like to ask Armando a question about sharks, or we've already covered coral and we're going to cover other things, I'm sure, before we're done here. So pretty much anything in the sea, I think, is fair game, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so you can call us here with that at 813-239-9663. Email TJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0855. So before we move on to sharks, I'm curious about at least one of your postgraduate courses. What sort of material is covered in a course on crocodile ecology?
That's a great question. So that course covered a little bit of behavior and also techniques on how to capture crocodiles and sex them, basically determine if they're from male or females, kind of to start studying population dynamics kind of thing. So it was all about learning.
I take it they're not freely moving around when you're trying to sex them at that
moment.
No,
they're not.
And they probably don't take kindly to that.
No, and yeah. It's kind of intrusive as well. But the little ones is easier, but the big ones, you really have to kind of manipulate them and get in there.
So but I'm sure their jaws are temporarily shut, right?
So yes. That's the thing. Any you know, crocodile, alligator, yeah, you have to make sure that you secure the head and the jaws. Kind of thing with sharks and the tails. So that you need a lot of people to, you probably seen it, you know, in videos and things like that. But yeah, you require a few people to, especially if it's a big animal.
Yeah. So, because I think there's still people in Florida or people that pass through Florida at the very least who are surprised to hear that crocodiles even are part of the Florida, you know, animal scene. You know, everybody's always sort of concerned with the gators, which I understand, but a lot of people had no idea that there were actually crocs here. And they're not that uncommon, right?
They're not that common. Because they're restricted. So they're a little bit more restricted by temperature and, so nation. So
what kind of temperatures do they favor versus where they...
Well, you know, I don't know the exact temperatures, but alligators, obviously, they are more north, this range of distribution. So in crocodiles are more in the tropics, subtropical areas.
Okay.
But alligators can be more subtropical and a little bit temperate. So it's a little bit behavior, but just expansion of the range, I think, as well. And people's perception of crocodiles has been very negative for many years as well. So that I think that also influences, you know, why they're not as common.
And are they moving? Are they migrating in some part of Florida to another part of Florida? And is that affecting their ability to cope with those temperatures? Or
I don't know if they're... I don't think they're moving. I don't study crocodiles at the moment, so I'm not current with that.
Sure.
But, temperature changes, so animals tend to move, and that's something that we see with fish, you know, reptiles, and so on and so on and so on. In the case of crocodiles, I think this hasn't happened as dramatically for them to be moving, and maybe also because we don't have very dense population of crocodiles, like you see maybe other animals.
But, I didn't know if they were... just for what they're eating or whatever, if they're making a small move in a direction that actually was counterproductive for them. Because I don't know why I thought I'd heard that.
Well, that has happened with other species, right? Like, sharks, all the fish as well, they're exploring other areas because they have access to it now, too.
All right, well, let's get to sharks, because that's really what we're mainly here for today. So what is it about sharks that made you want to study them? Like what traits in particular drew you?
Yeah, so let's back up when I was a child again. You asked me about my childhood. So I went to a school that had a logo or mascot was a shark. And so I always had that, you know, mascot through my whole... So that was my elementary, middle, high school. So I always had a shark on my shirt. We wear uniforms. So since I was...
Oh, that was the mascot. Sorry, I didn't catch that at first. Yeah. That was the school mascot. Yeah. So sharks were inculcated very early.
Yes, but we didn't really have a mascot, like a mascot, you know, like at sport events. Nobody will scream, sharks, sharks. But for some reason, we had that little... And so I was intrigued, why? And then I realized that the logo we had, a bull shark. And that's how I learned about bull sharks, that they actually can move into freshwater systems very far inland compared to other sharks. So that fascinated me, that shark can be, you know, in the middle of Nicaragua, basically, in Lake Nicaragua, and you see them here going, you know, up at the Mississippi River, so, and the Amazonian, and these are shark species that are not, well, even, there were even some people proposing that maybe they were freshwater sharks, which is such a thing.
There's no such thing as a freshwater shark, right?
No, yeah. There's no such thing. Freshwater
shark. So it's just sharks that make their way into freshwater, like the bull sharks you're talking about.
And they can cope with it with some changes. Some of them, you know, they have physiologically, they were able to tolerate Los Salinitis.
Yeah.
And that's what they take into advantage. And there's reason why they do that. But yeah, so that's kind of got me started. And then obviously reading about it. And then we were talking before the show started, then, you know, the movie Jaws, well, the book Jaws, and then the movie also.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Because that, I mean, it was a cultural phenomenon then, but the impact still seems to resonate now, you know, decades later after the book and especially the movies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a great movie. More shy biologists than I know love that movie, by the way.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I love that movie, and it's hilarious. And Steven Spielberg did a good job, but the book itself is good too. So Peter, he wrote this book, right, eventually, and he felt so bad about it because after the movie, everybody becomes paranoid about sharks and the phobia of sharks, and they trigger a massive killing and eradication of sharks around coastal and beaches, but, you know, tourist places. And yeah, it changed the perception and increased the fear, I guess, on sharks. So he felt so bad after that he spent basically the rest of his life advocating for sharks because he understood that they were super important creatures. But yeah, so that whole movement make a lot of people very scared of sharks, which is kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, no, that's, I don't think I knew that he felt so bad that he did all that subsequently. Yeah. So how did you decide the areas of study to concentrate on for your PhD? It's reproductive behavior and population structure, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm going to elaborate into that. So in reality, I love animal behavior. That's my passion. So I work with urchins, manatees, coral reef communities, things like that. I like to ask questions about why animals do what they do and where they go. And one of the main things in sharks that fascinated me too is that all sharks, doesn't matter if the deep water shark, coastal shark, little tiny sharks, big sharks, they all have internal fertilization. So that means the male have to meet with the female and the sperm is basically put into the females and then they, you know, do the thing.
And baby sharks happen.
And baby sharks happen, yeah. And there's many different mechanisms that have to do that. They're very diverse. But there's a lot of observation in the shark species that they actually segregate by sex. So they don't live together. Females go one way and males go that way.
Other than when they come together for mating?
Yes.
So they're always on a separate path?
When they're sexually mature. Yeah, that's been observed in a lot of the species of sharks that we've seen from deep sea to, you know, coastal
and
pelagic.
Why is that? Is there some concern for safety or, I mean?
And that's exactly why I got into this because there's a lot of, so there's some good observations. There's some okay hypotheses, but there's not really good explanations. Like the ultimate factors.
Are you working on that yourself?
And that's what I'm working on myself.
Okay.
So I'm trying to find explanations why this is happening because some people claim it to be because of the harassment of males to females, which in order to internal fertilization to happen, the males have to actually grab into the females and they bite. They don't have limbs like or arms, right? They do have pectoral things.
Because what has to happen for the mating?
Yes.
The females get roughed up.
Yeah, get roughed.
Even if the males aren't intending to do that, it's just kind of the nature of the mating act, I guess, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, there's some scarring, there's some, you know, punctures. But in fact, a lot of the female sharks have actually thicker tissue in those areas where the males crab. So they heal pretty well. There's no damage to the organs. But that was been one of the main reasons why people thought, or at least proposed, that was the case. And it might not be, but who knows? But
yeah.
But there are all the factors that might be, you know, affecting this.
How would we find out?
Well, and that's part of my research, right?
Okay.
Trying to come.
I just happen to have the man here who's researching that very topic. Yeah.
So it's a complex, they're complex questions because sharks are hard to study, especially the highly migratory ones.
I'm sure.
And observe them like through times. We've gotten better with technology, but it's still very challenging. So that's the question, why they're doing this and how. So how do you go about this? So one of the things I'm looking is doing, obviously, literature review, like any researcher, to see what the most common, I guess, explanations, to see how valid they are, what are the hypotheses, can we test the hypothesis, how we test the hypothesis. So there's many ways to go around this.
Yeah.
And that's part of my research, right, that I'm looking into it and trying to come up with answers.
Did they travel kind of separately, males, females, for a long time, or is this something that's been more recently observable and more pronounced?
Well, once again, you know, we have about 500 species of sharks.
Right.
So they not all do the same thing, same way.
Sure.
But those sharks, when people think about sharks, you come into, you, what you think about is, you know, tiger sharks, the white sharks, the blue sharks, the bull sharks, just the big sharks.
The big famous
which
ones.
Which are not the majority. In fact, the majority of sharks are 1 meter long and brown and small.
Don't bother anybody.
And don't bother anybody. And actually, half of them are like very deep, 300 meters or so. So, you know, we don't have access to them, at least swimming. So they a lot of these sharks, they actually migrate and they do meet each other sometimes in mating sites or feeding grounds. But for example, the white sharks in Australia, they've been studying some of those population of white sharks for a long time. And they have found out that males and females arrive to the same place to feed, but females arrive a little sooner than the males when the water's a little warmer. So some people thinking that's the temperature is driven this sex segregation.
The separation of male and female.
Females, at least for temporal.
Water temperature
at
a certain feeding ground.
Yes. And but there's other studies like the Spirnalini, this hammerhead off the coast of California, right? The females seem to be going to deeper waters sooner. So the juveniles, because they have access to, and again, this is keeps being looking into it, right?
Yeah.
It's not definitive yet, that they move into deeper water sooner age because they need to reach, so to have better access to nutrients and to food that will make them grow faster and larger, because they need that to in order to become sexually mature. So sharks, we estimate sexual maturity, not just in age, but also in size. So they have to acquire a certain size to be able to be sexually mature. And females tend to be larger than males, so they tend to be take a little longer. So if you go to a site that you have maybe, you know, better food that will accelerate the process, that's something that's an advantage. So it seems like those hammerheads are actually doing that.
So hammerhead females, maybe other shark species as well, the females are larger than the males?
Yes.
So in a way, that almost seems like hard to reconcile with the thing about males roughing them up, and maybe that's why they're part of why they're traveling separately, because it seems like if they were bigger, they wouldn't be as affected by that. But I guess that's not the case.
And again, it's still to be seen, right? But but when the problem is sometimes you have more than one male, and then you have three or four males, right? So so it might not be that the females cannot defend themselves, but it's just the constant harassment of that they have to
expend
energy.
Here's another male right over here.
They have to spend energy. And instead of feeding, now you're like deterring from males. And again, that's not all species. That's some of the species that they've been noticed that.
Yeah.
But there's all their potential hypotheses for why they're doing this. One, like I was telling you, maybe nutrients. Other ones are to protect their youngs. And so there are multiple explanations.
In your research, are you focusing on certain species? Just because it seems like it'd be unmanageable otherwise, unless you just picked a small number or a few and just said, okay, we're going to look at this carefully.
Yeah, both. So I'm actually looking at families. I'm looking at, in the way I'm approaching this, I'm looking at different families of sharks. I'm also looking at reproductive modes because it might be tied to how they reproduce in terms of how they feed the embryos and gestation periods and things like that. And also I'm narrowing down into some of those species that might be more closely in some family kind of thing. So I'm looking at the big picture and narrow it down in maybe a species level.
And how far into your research are you, and how much more sort of time or effort do you expect it to take before you get to where you're ready to write your thesis?
Yeah, well, I'm in the process of writing it at the moment.
So
I think in a year and a half, I'll be done.
So you already can start writing it, and then you're still awaiting results that you'll obviously plug in, and that'll help you finish the thesis.
Yes, and most likely what we'll do, because this is a big question, right, and it's not going to be easier to answer, and I might not have all the answers.
Right.
I think this is going to continue on, maybe a postdoc, but I'll continue looking into this, I think, through my whole life.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's going to be significant, because it sounds like these are big questions amongst your fellow shark researchers, and so if you come up with something even potentially that partially answers it, that's going to be a huge advance,
and
right?
It is huge, not just for the science, scientists were interested in knowing how things works in nature, but not just because of that, but also for management. We understand how important sharks are, at least a lot of people and agencies, especially in the United States, and we want to protect them. And if you have the same species of adult mature sharks doing different things, going different places, you managing, it's like managing two different species. So now your management approach might have to change in order to actually be effective. So if you know that they're actually segregated by sex and why and when, then you need to incorporate that bring that into the conservation or management of those species. So it will be beneficial as well for the management and conservation of these creatures.
And that'll affect like the public, I guess, in some ways, depending on where certain beaches are, where they might get into water, where sharks are, and what knowledge this produces that you're working on.
Oh, absolutely.
Help people figure out if they're getting in or if they're not getting in there, I guess, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. Another reason why, you know, we need to know exactly where they go. And we know some of these migratory patterns of some of the sharks, and that's something that people need to know as well. When the bull sharks are here in Florida, you know, when the big bull sharks are in the estuary, so I don't go in there, at least not at the time that they're there, to minimize.
It's risky if they're in that phase, right, when they're ready to mate. They're probably that much more aggressive than they might otherwise be.
That I don't know for certain. But they also go to places, let's go aside from the mating, right? Sometimes, like we're talking about bull sharks, they go to freshwater, brackish water system like estuaries to deliver the pups. So basically like a nursery grounds for their babies because there's less likely big fish that will eat their babies. So the shark can acquire a certain size and they leave and be a little safer, you know, reduce mortality. So I won't tie the potential risk factor to a particular activity unless it's feeding, because if feeding frenzy, then instinctively, right, they start taking bites. But it's just understanding why they congregate or aggregate in certain areas and what time of the years, I think. And it varies. Sometimes mating, sometimes feeding, sometimes delivering their babies. So it changes.
Because, you know, one of the things, I guess, just as a general question is, you know, I guess related to sort of your population structure and your reproductive behavior that you're addressing now. But the shark population in certain regions seems to have either grown or maybe just shifted in a way that would account for what appears to be an increase in shark attacks. Now, I know we're getting into a highly controversial area and highly debated, and I'm sure scientists say one thing and everybody else says almost totally the opposite, right?
Yes.
But is some of that shift, the sheer number of attacks, which we'll get into whether there's more attacks or more reports in a sec, but the number of attacks is greater by the shift in the population that you described by where they're moving and where they're having babies and how long they're staying, right?
Well, it's many different things there. So, yes, we are protecting sharks in a better way than we did in the past, in some countries, right? That includes the United States. Some of the population of sharks that were declining, now they're coming back.
And how was that achieved? How was that rebound achieved?
Yeah, so basically reducing fisheries.
Okay.
More regulations, educations as well. Opening the fisheries for certain species, closing it for others if the numbers are declining. Scientists contributing to understanding the life history of these animals, which that's a big part of why sharks are a threat, because they have this very, they live long time, they don't reach some maturity until they're late, and so on and so on. And I can talk more about that if you want. But yeah, so some sharks populations in certain areas are increasing, and as well as the uses of those areas by humans, right? We always go and swim in, we always have transportation, use the sea and the oceans to transport goods and things and recreation, but that's increasing. And it's also increasing, not just the use, but the documentation of us doing those things. Right, so everybody has a camera with a phone on it, so we have a video. Surfing, now it's surfing, kite surfing, windsurfing, all the different things. So it's more usage of water bodies, and some populations are increasing. So yeah, so it's more overlapping of, I guess, humans and shark interactions. What is not increasing, though, is the shark attacks. That's not actually happening. And people ask me, so how do you know this? Well, there's actually a really good place that you can find that out, and you can likely look at database. There's the Florida Museum, the Natural History Museum based at the University of Florida, has a program. It's called the Florida International, it's called International Attack File, Shark Attack File. And that's the only scientific-based database that keeps track of all the sharks attacks around the world. And you can see statistics, and you can see there's not, there's sometimes there are years in certain areas that, you know, there might be attack or two, but overall, there's not an increase, even with the increase of some of these populations. What have increased, though, a little bit is the some negative interaction between fishers and sharks, because there are more sharks, right? And So they're taking fishes from fishers' hooks and things like that.
Fighting for food, basically.
Fighting for food. And not only sharks. I mean, Goliath grouper do that. You know, dolphins do that. So there's all other organisms to blame. But yeah, but so it's a combination of things. And one thing that also is happening is that because climate is changing, so water currents are changing a little bit. So sometimes sharks are moving, are being pushed in close to coastlines, and they're prey too. So they fall on their prey. So that's sometimes you see sharks that maybe you were not seeing before in places that now they're showing up.
So can anybody access this attack file, or do you have to be a scientist?
No, that's open to the public, and it has all the information there, and it has
where would someone go to find that?
So you can go directly to the Florida Natural History Museum website, which is, again, that is the Natural History Museum, it's at UF campus.
Okay.
But you can go directly to the International Shark Attack File, and just any web browser, you will find it. And this is, again, maintained by scientists. So it's not just, you know, speculations.
Right.
And they do check that when it happened, how it happened. And they have two ways of classifying shark attack. They have unprovoked and provoke, which, again, is good to know, because sometimes some attacks are totally unprovoked and accidental and nothing happened, really. So
isn't it interesting, at least to me it is, Armando, that so there at least one or more other organizations wouldn't have subsequently started their own file, similar approach, maybe slightly different, just so it wasn't completely a duplicate. But it seems fascinating to me there's only one in the world of these.
I don't know if there's more, but I know scientifically based, that's the only
the
one.
The only one that holds that status.
Know. There might be others that, you know, keep track of shark attacks, but they're not at the level of as objective, I should say, as these folks.
So this file, I guess, helps us decide the debate about are there more, what I think a lot of people think there's more shark attacks, and the people that are scientists like yourself and others think same number, just more reports.
Yes.
And so this file, I guess, would kind of document that distinction.
Yeah, and it's also, I like knowledge, right? So they also show you all the costs of death by other things, you know, like lightning and being trumped by a cow, things like that. So you can compare the numbers.
Yeah.
And then you'll see that you're more at risk maybe to getting, you know, hit by a bus than than actually beaten by a
shark. So really, what the file makes clear is there's no question that the number of attacks is basically remains status quo.
Yeah.
And there's just the reports in the media and stuff like that is shot way up.
Yes. And of course, there's certain areas, certain years that may be more attacks than others through the year. So it might seem that it's an increase, but if overall, it's not.
Yeah. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Stress. I'm speaking with shark expert Armando Ubeda, who will be giving a talk as part of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival happening April 9th through 12th in and around Apollo Beach. His lecture on April 10th is entitled Coastal Sharks of Florida. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have any questions about sharks or anything related, you can call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. All right, so let's, before we run out of time, Armando, I guess we should see if we can get a little sneak preview of your lecture, again, Coastal Sharks of Florida. So let's start at what may be the remedial level. What sharks are considered coastal sharks?
Yes, that's a great question. Well, coastal sharks are, what I consider coastal sharks are the ones that you know, you can see or at least frequent the coastline at some point. Like, for example, white sharks. People think about white sharks as pelagic sharks.
Yeah.
And yeah, that might be most the case because they're actually more, but they can come closer to the coastline. So it depends who you ask, right? So in this talk, what I will try to do is to give a little bit of, kind of talked about the evolution of sharks because they go way back, and try to break it down by the different, highlighting the diversity of sharks, some of the different orders that we have, and bring them examples of sharks that actually that belong to those orders that actually we find here. So yes, I'll focus on those sharks. Coastal are those considered sharks from 0 to, you know, maybe like 300 meters depth. That's kind of considered coastal in terms of, and they live closer to the continents, but they doesn't mean that they don't go into, you know, this transatlantic migrations or things like that.
They could be both or do both at one part of their...
Yeah, but I'll concentrate on some of the ones actually very coastal, like the boneheads, which is smaller, the hammerheads. Those are very tied into the estuaries and along the shorelines as well. They don't make big excursion into the depths and things like that. So I'll touch base in a few of here and there, and I use the coastal in a very loosey way because I like to talk about sharks in general.
Yeah.
So I also talk to the one that we see occasionally.
So are coastal sharks, by their very nature, we've already, I think, addressed the debate thoroughly, but are they often associated with attacks on swimmers in shallow water because they're closer to the shore, obviously, than the ones that are way out or way deep?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but again, it's how, when you think about coastal, right? Because you can have the Gulf Coast that we have here is very shallow, most part. So you can be in a very shallow area for long distance.
Yeah.
If you go some parts of the East Coast of Florida, right, the continental shelf drops really quickly. So you might be in a coastal environment, but very deep access to water. So you might see some species that, like, again, white shark, things like that. You might not see them, which they do go into the Gulf. So again, the term coastal is kind of loose, but yeah, it is because people have more access, obviously, to those areas, and that's where they see them.
Yeah. So what else should we know without giving away your talk? Because people should come hear your talk, obviously. But what are one other tidbit or fact or interesting observation about coastal sharks that we should know?
Yeah, so what I will talk about, well, I not only highlight some of these cool species that we have, some of the unique adaptations that they have, mm-hmm. but they have, you know, evolved with to thrive and be successful. I will talk also about regulations, because a lot of people know that some species are more regulated than others. There's licenses that you're supposed to have. For example, if you're going to fish for sharks from the shoreline, you have to have a license, which is free. You can get it by taking a course in the FWC website, which is the Florida Conservation Commission, Wildlife Conservation Commission. So there, I'm going to also talk about regulations and why those things and some of the threats that sharks face and some of the conservation efforts and how people can get involved, because there's a lot of things that people can do to support shark research and conservation as well.
Yeah. So is there, with shark fishing and other stuff, is that have a direct impact on their population or do those regulations, I guess the license probably inherently keep it limited to how many sharks can be fished or killed that way?
Yeah, and recreational fishing is not as big of a problem. It can be for the individual goes caught, but this also, I won't talk much about the commercial regulation, which is the ones that have bigger impact on the health of this population of sharks. But yeah, but the regulations I'll focus in is more like the impact people like you and I, if you want to go fishing, because yeah, that's minimizing risk to yourself, minimizing risk to the animals, and yeah, keeping healthy organisms. For example, so some of the great hammerheads that we see now around the coastline,
yeah,
they're here normally at the time when they're pregnant. So, well, that one you can take. But so also teach you how to release an animal safely for the safety of that individual, which, yeah, it will have an impact on the population itself. So if people are doing the right thing, handling sharks in the right way, it will minimize fatalities of those, which have a positive impact on the population.
Yeah, because now and again, you see these horrible stories about people that were trying to catch a shark, or worse, they were actually just trying to antagonize it and mm-hmm. make it suffer. And you just think, oh my God, what? There's got to be some kind of laws in place for that. It sounds like there are.
Yeah, and there are. And also, I think a lot of people lack of empathy because they don't know how cool and important and
they're scared of sharks.
Yeah, and
it's back to the Benchley Jaws thing, I guess.
Yes,
in a weird
exactly.
way, right?
Yes, yeah. And there's so many incredible things about sharks that, I mean, we could spend days talking about.
Yeah. So over the course of your research, what's one or two things about sharks that you came upon in the course of your research that you didn't know, even though you were steeped in all kinds of aquatic things that we've talked about from your Nicaragua days and beyond? But what did you find out somewhere along the line about sharks? We thought, wow, I had no idea, and that's really fascinating.
That's a great question. I don't know if there's something. I mean, I'm fascinated by. I'm very easy to get fascinated by things.
Yeah.
I guess one of the things that is, well, I don't have a definite answer for this, but the fact that they might be going, some species might be going to some place to eat, but they're keeping, they're basically feeding at different water depths, and that might be linked to temperature.
Mm.
More than avoidance to being together. And just the temperature, I won't say constraints, but preferable different temperatures.
Right.
So the visitors sense side, but they're using it in a different way.
But is that gender specific, back to what we were talking about before, about men and women jerks.
Female males.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm talking about. Now they're all dressed up. It's some kind of evening gown thing. But you know, traveling in separate paths, is that part of this formula as well?
Yeah, and again, it's very specific to a certain species. But yeah, that's something that fascinated me because, again, that's before we didn't have any clue about this. And this has been part also because of some of the resources we have now, right? We have better ways to capture environmental factors and pull animals and do things like that. So yes, science has evolved too, which is great. And
are you optimistic about the future of sharks?
I want to say yes, and I am. I am in at least in localized areas. I think, and we still have a lot of issues. Again, sharks, they don't understand borders, right? They move between countries and international waters, and there's a lot of abuse and illegal activities happening regarding wildlife. But yeah, I want to say that yes, I'm optimistic that sharks will be better.
That's great. And it sounded like before we go, maybe you'll recommend one or two great shark textbooks or resources that you have.
Yeah, so we have a long history, a legacy of shark researchers here in Florida, but two of my favorite books that I always recommend people is, one of them is The Sharks of North America by Dr. Jose Castro. It's a beautiful book. It's a very big book, but it has all the species that you will find here in North America, very well described. Fantastic illustrations. But there's another book, it's called Sharks Biology and Conservation by Dr. Daniel Abel and Dr. Dean Grubbs. And that one is go very in depth into some of the biology and ecology of sharks, but also it's very easy to read and very general. So in fact, they claim that this book is for educators, students, and enthusiasts. So it's very nice and easy to read. So that's just two examples of books. But like I said, there's so much legacy of shark
research.
Yeah,
like you say, Florida is brimming with great researchers over many, many years.
So. Absolutely.
And I think you're probably one of them. This has been Armando Ubeda. And again, he's giving a great talk as part of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival happening. The festival itself happens over 4 days' time, April 9th through 12th, in and around Apollo Beach. His lecture is on April 10th, entitled Coastal Sharks of Florida. And you can find out more about the festival and schedules and all kinds of stuff by going to their website, floridabirdingandnaturefestival.org. So, Armando, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals today. Really fascinating, and sounds like you clearly find sharks endlessly fascinating yourself.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with Ann Paul, an organizer of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival, happening again April 9th through 12th in and around Apollo Beach. More on that in just a moment. Right now, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with the late, great Robert Schimmel and his shark-relevant piece I picked out as a nod to Armando called Punching a Shark in the Nose. Today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
My brother scuba dives. He goes, oh, you know what you do if a shark's bothering you? Bothering? You need to look in a dictionary, pal. It really bothers me when you shear my legs off at the hips. I find it very bothersome to get back to shore with my torso snapped in half. He said, what you do is you let the shark get up to you and then you punch him in the face. Yeah, and then when that doesn't work, you poke him in the eye with your stump. Punch a shark? What if he wasn't even going to attack you? What if he's just curious and he's swimming by and he goes, hey, what the f***? What'd you do that for? I thought you were going to attack me. I'm going to now. I was going to let you go, but the other sharks are watching. It doesn't look good now.
That was the late, great Robert Schimmel in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Punching a Shark in the Nose, taken from one of his club performances back in the day. Now it's time to speak with Ann Paul, an organizer of the Florida Birding and Nature Festival happening April 9th through 12th. Let's welcome Ann Paul back to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Ann.
Hey, thanks for having me talk about the festival.
Sure, seems like a good topic.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's just a great opportunity for people to get together and talk about wildlife and nature and birds.
For sure. Well, maybe to start, maybe you could give us a brief overview of the festival, when it was launched, what was the impetus for starting the festival, and so on.
So this is actually the ninth year we've conducted the festival in Hillsborough County. It originally started over in Pinellas as a means to encourage tourism during the fall, and it lasted there about 7 years and then kind of winked out. But now we've had it 9 years here in Hillsborough County. And the reason we're doing it is to promote nature, wildlife habitat conservation and proper management, and just trying to encourage people to learn about this very special area of the world that we have, and to encourage people to help us work together to protect it.
And I guess we should know, for people who've kind of followed it, at least from a distance, that this is the first year it's being held in April. It had been, I guess, in October up to the recent years.
Yes, we've been holding it during the fall migration, when so many birds slide through the Tampa Bay area on their way south from nesting. But we just moved to the spring to avoid the hurricane. And so now we're celebrating the spring migration, when birds are coming from Central and South America through this area as they move up into North America to breed for the summer and raise their chicks. So we think it'll be a wonderful time to have the festival. We expect to see 200 or species or more when we're all together out on our field trips, and particularly some of the rarer species that people really come to this area to observe.
Yeah.
So we're excited about it.
So it's 4 days, April 9th through 12th, plenty of things offered each day. Of course, we can't necessarily cover them all, but we did just speak with Armando, so we know, of course, about his great shark talk coming up on April 10th. But maybe you could describe a few events of one kind or another, or talks, anything you might want to, just to give kind of a sense of the scope of the festival.
Sure. We're offering field trips all 4 days of the festival. We're actually offering 31 field trips. Many of them are walking tours, but also we've got a bus tour. We've got kayaking. We've got wagon rides, so people can get around nature preserves easily. And then we've also got 14 different talks, you know, one of which you just heard about with the shark. But they are dealing with a wide variety of nature aspects, because it's Florida birding and nature. So we've got stuff about birds, and we have stuff about wildlife area conservation, restoration, and we actually have an art talk by John Costin, who's one of our best local bird artists in the area, well known. And then in addition to that, we're offering the Nature Expo, which is an opportunity for people to come to the festival itself, which is going to be in Apollo Beach at the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's Youth Conservation Center, and which is a lovely campus area. And, you know, you can buy binoculars or bird art or bird houses, or talk to people, say, from the Water Management District or the Port Authority or the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and some of the Audubon chapters and Sierra Club and all those different groups about what they're doing to conserve nature in our area. And particularly the Hillsborough County's Environment Lands Program is going to be there, and they're going to bring some information about prescribed fire. And a special thing that we're doing is we're having a live flying bird performance. Steve Hoddy is coming down with his an eagle, a hawk, a falcon, and an owl, and he's going to be showing those wild birds and also flying them right before our eyes. He's a falconer. It's going to be so exciting. And that's on Saturday, April 11th, two performances at the Nature Expo area. So there's a lot going on. The Nature Expo and the bird performance are free and open to the public. There is a cost to go on the field trips and to attend the lectures, but we also have two keynotes, speakers on Friday and Saturday nights. Leslie Kemp Poole is going to be talking about the role of women in conservation through the decades and up to today. And then on Friday, Hilary Flower will be talking about the relationship between snails, kites, and their snail prey, which is very exciting. So all of this is just something that we're excited to present.
Sure. Talk about something for everybody. My goodness, you're covering so much ground here.
Well, we are trying to, you know, get the general public out to enjoy nature, but also to learn about why Hillsborough County and the counties around here are collectively so important, you know, and
yeah.
In the light of the supreme development that's going on, it's really important to protect acre by acre and then properly manage those nature preserves. And we're excited to present that story.
For sure. It's just gives you a chance to really get up close and see the elements of that story in your walk, on your hike, in your boat, wherever you might be, whatever thing you choose to do. So let's just mention that the website to find out the scheduling and some of these events that Anna's been talking about and many more that she didn't even have a chance to mention. There's that many. It's FloridaBirdingAndNatureFestival.org, and that's where you can find out the whole scoop and sign up for things and get more equipped for the long weekend, April 9th through 12th. So, Ann, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals. I think it's going to be a great festival once again this year.
Thanks so much, Duncan. We're really excited about it.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mauro Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Vall, holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C, hosting the Wednesday Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m. And just more great music and stuff happens after that here on 885 WNF. Meanwhile, on this show at the moment, as a prize for name that I don't think, I'll be offering something fabulous from the Talking Animals Vault. To the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this song, just name that animal tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. Just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We'll take any guesses to the name of the animal tune off the air right after we finish the show here on Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Next Wednesday, April 8th, I'll be joined by Melanie Sue Bowles, founder and director of Proud Spirits Horse Sanctuary, who alongside her husband Jim has shepherded the sanctuary through nearly 35 years of challenges, changes, and relocations in service of rescuing horses and providing them refuge. I spoke with Melanie a few times over the 20 plus years of this show, and I look forward to speaking with her again next Wednesday, April 8th, for an update on her. She's also an accomplished author, by the way, and on Proud Spirit Horse Sanctuary itself. So I hope you'll join us for that conversation next Wednesday, April 8th, here on Talking Animals on WNF. So I invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. Apple Podcasts are available there too, as well as on other podcast platforms. There are also links to our social media pages. You can subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. So I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind animals. Be kind others. Be kind yourself. This is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Stay tuned for The Conversation coming right up after The Scoop. And more great programming after that here, as always, on WMNF Tampa. All right, we'll catch you next Wednesday with Melanie Sue Bull talking about horse rescue and other cool topics on Talking Animals. Thanks.